It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strange-Champs. Today, the heart of darkness. Now, there's a question that has been around for a long time. Are humans innately violent? That is, if you strip the civilization out of us, just how bad would we be? So first, we're going to talk about one of the most acclaimed documentaries of the past year, the Academy Award-nominated film The Act of Killing. It follows a former Indonesian death squad leader as he remembers and even reenacts the atrocities he committed. Charles Monroe Kane talked with American director Josh Oppenheimer, who spent 5 years making this film. And Charles, let's get some background first.
Well, and the film is about what happened in Indonesia in 1965. If you remember, that's when the government was overthrown by a military coup, and this was the U.S.-backed coup that put Suharto in power. But in that process, in less than a year, more than 1 million people were killed, 1 million alleged communists. And to this day, the death squad leaders have never been brought to justice.
So how did Oppenheimer go about making the film?
It's really unique. He did something I've never seen before. He made the film from the point of view of the perpetrators, not the victims. He told me it wasn't hard to find them and that they were everywhere. Everywhere he went, every street corner, he would find them, and they were completely proud to tell the story.
I found, to my horror, really, that every perpetrator in the village was immediately boastful about the worst details of the killings, which they would recount with smiles on their faces, often in front of their families, even their small grandchildren. I had this awful feeling that I'd wandered into Germany 40 years after the Holocaust, only to find the Nazis still very much in power. I showed this material back to those survivors who wanted to see it. Not all of them did, but many did. And then to the broader Indonesian human rights community, and everybody said, keep filming the perpetrators. You're onto something so important, because anyone who sees this anywhere in the world will be forced to finally acknowledge the rotten heart of this regime of fear and corruption and theft and plunder that the killers have built and which is still very much in place.
What I think we need to make sure we hear for people who haven't seen this film, this isn't a Talking Heads documentary. They're just not sitting there with a black, you know, background like Ken Burns behind them. You have these guys not only boasting what they did, but you let them act it out in Hollywood genres like John Wayne on horses or old-fashioned gangster films. Josh, where did that idea come from that you'd have these men show you how they kill people, how they torture people? It was incredible.
For 2 years, I filmed every perpetrator I could find across North Sumatra, and all of them were boastful. All of them would, within minutes of meeting me, offer to take me to the places they killed, whereupon when we'd arrive there, they would launch into spontaneous demonstrations of how they killed.
Man.
And complain afterwards that they hadn't thought to bring along, for example, a friend to play a victim or a machete to use as a prop. And so I proposed to them very directly, look, you've participated in one of the biggest killings in human history, and I could be that open with them because they, of course, were that open with me about the fact that they'd killed. I want to know what it means to you and to your society. I would say, you want to show me what you've done, so show me in whatever way you wish, and I will film your reenactments, but also your discussions around them.
It's incredible, because they're wearing, like, Humphrey Bogart hats, and, I mean, one scene, there's a, you know, a fish that looks like it's about 2 stories tall, and one of the perpetrators is in drag, and there's dancing girls. They're dressed as cowboys. It is so surreal to watch the murders and tortures in that set. And one of the surreal parts of it all, which is good to the heart of any documentary, is a person. His name's Anwar Kongo. Can you tell me how you met him and how he became the central person in your film?
As I mentioned, I spent 2 years filming every perpetrator I could find, and Anwar was the 41st perpetrator I met at the end of that 2 year period. And in many ways, my first encounter with him was like everybody else. I'd been referred to him by other perpetrators who said, by the time I reached Medan, a number of people had started to point to him and say, this was is really the most notorious death squad leader or executioner in the city. It's the third biggest city in Indonesia, about the size of Chicago. So it's a big city. And try and film him. So I approached him one day. And when I arrived at his house, there was his wife had guests, and he said, okay, I'm happy to tell you about what we did in the 60s, but why don't I take you to the place we did it, and I'll show you what we did. And he takes me to a roof terrace above what is now a handbag store, but used to be a paramilitary office, a newspaper office, and it was the place where they were torturing and interrogating the opponents of the new military dictatorship. When they were finished interrogating them, they would haul them upstairs and kill them on this roof terrace. And Anwar takes me there and shows me how he went about it, and shows me how he used wire to kill because it was relatively bloodless and easier to clean up. And this was the very first day that I met him. And it's an early scene in the film. And after showing me, he does something in many ways that was typical of a first shoot with a perpetrator, taking me to the place where he's killed, showing me how he killed. There was nothing unique there, even thinking to bring along props. He brings along a wire. That wasn't so unusual. But what was really unusual was what happened next, where he says, you know, I have nightmares from what I've done. I've been trying to forget it. I go out drinking and taking drugs and dancing to forget what I've done. So he acknowledges a trauma, a pain. And then he says, and to forget all of this, I would go out dancing. I'm a good dancer, look. And he starts to dance the cha-cha-cha in the place where he's killed all these people, as though almost to banish the horror that he's just described. And the dancing was one of the most absurd, surreal, grotesque metaphors for what happens when killers win. And I started to wonder, because his pain was right there on the surface, whether perhaps the boasting that so many perpetrators, all the other perpetrators, had indulged in, perhaps that boasting might not be a sign of pride, but might be something much easier to understand, something much more human. I started to wonder whether boasting and remorse are two sides of the same coin.
There's an amazing moment in the film. I'll set it up for our listeners here, where it's about your presence in the film. And Anwar, who we're talking about, he's demonstrating how to decapitate someone. He's an actor, and his neck's already cut, you know, in the Hollywood makeup. And then he stops. You see his face completely change, and he looks to you and says, I know how my victims felt. I know what it would like to be tortured. And you immediately snap back at him and say, no, you don't. No, you don't, because they're all going to die, and you know you're going to live. There are many times in the film you hear someone say, hey, Josh, hey, watch this. Hey, Josh, what do you think? What was your role in the film when you were able to say to someone that you're wrong, to a murderer?
I don't think I was really angry there. I think that I might have been disappointed by his, yet again, when it was clear he was starting at that point in the process to feel some, looked like to me, remorse, that then he tried to run away from it by offering me this kind of easy version of empathy. And so like, oh, now I empathize, I know what it was like. And early in the process, I made a decision that I would not make the leap from saying this man has done something monstrous to this man is a monster. Because the former is true. He has done something monstrous. He's done something terrible. But the latter, that the man is a monster, isn't true. The man's a human being. And if we're going to have any chance of preventing killing, we have to understand it. And to understand killing, we have to look at the human beings who kill and listen to them and try and understand what they experience and why. And I also recognize by condemning him simply and saying this man is a monster, I would be reassuring myself that I'm totally unlike him. And while I would hope if I grew up in his family in 1950s Indonesia with his siblings, with his peer group, with that political context, I would hope that in 1965, at the time of the killings, I would hope I would make different decisions. But I know I'm extremely lucky never to have to find out. And that meant that I had to approach him as a human being.
Right.
And in approaching him as a human being, it meant that I had to be honest with him and build rapport in the way you build rapport with human beings, which is to be honest, ultimately, if you're going to work with someone for years and years and years.
Has he ever brought up to you, or do you bring up to him, issues of redemption, the idea of trying to earn back or at least pay penance for what he's done?
Only really once, when Anwar saw the film and said to me, there's nothing left for me to do with my life than to die. And that was a terrible thing to hear from someone you care for, especially after it's in response to a film that I've made with him and about him. And I said to him, and I guess I didn't use the word redemption, but I said, you know, Anwar, whatever good you do in the rest of your life isn't undermined by the bad things you've done in the past. That's not to say that, you know, in the sort of calculus of justice, he could ever make up for what he's done. But he could live the rest of his life with some meaning. He could do meaningful things with the rest of his life. And I think I was wondering whether he might have the courage to speak out against the killings, to join the sort of human rights community, which has been very mobilized by the film and very energized by the film in speaking out against what has happened and taking some responsibility for it, apologizing for it. He hasn't done that. And I'm not surprised.
What about you? You spent all these years making and hearing all these atrocities. watching all these reenactments of real murders and real tortures and real rape, how did you hold up during all those years filming that? What were your dreams like?
There's a scene where Anwar shows how he might have killed a child by butchering a teddy bear. And it's part of, it's like it starts as a game with Herman dressed as a fat gangster in a fedora and a suit. Herman, Anwar's portly sidekick and protege, playing, improvising as part of his kind of game, the mother of this teddy bear, trying to bribe Anwar, save his own life or her own life in the case of, in the context of the game, by offering her daughter to Anwar. The daughter's just this stupid teddy bear. And Anwar butchers the teddy bear. And I think what was most chilling there is he blames Herman. He says, you're the real barbarian. He blames the victim. And of course, the whole fantasy of the victim trying to save herself by offering her daughter is a lie in the minds of the perpetrator to help justify what he's done. It's a moment where the film is not giving you any kind of glimpse on what happened, but a glimpse into how the perpetrators justify it in their darkest moments. And when we were shooting that scene, it's really an awful scene, and it's, I think, one of the most important.
It is, it's an awful scene, yeah.
But when we were shooting that scene, Anwar's microphone was rubbing against his suit, and I had to call cut to fix his microphone. And Anwar looked at me and said, Josh, you're crying. And I felt my face. I didn't know I was crying. It's the only time in my life where I found that I was crying without realizing that I was crying. And I said, wow, so I am. And Anwar said, what shall we do about it? And I said, well, we'll continue shooting the scene, which we did, obviously pushing myself beyond some threshold. I went home that evening feeling utterly tainted. Like in order to deal with the trauma that lurks just below the surface, I've had to immerse myself in it and tainted by it. And that was, in my mind, the beginning of about 8 months of really terrible nightmares, where I would wake up, not be able to sleep for the rest of the night. The next day, I would be afraid of sleeping and have insomnia. The next night, it would start again. That went on for about 8 months. I got through it because of my wonderful Indonesian crew. These are people who remain anonymous still, to protect their safety and my family. But it is very emotionally impactful. There's no denying that.
You know, Joshua, in the end, after all the surreal reenactments and gut-wrenching admissions and just an intense film, one of the most powerful moments for me in the film was this mundane moment in a car where one of the leaders of the genocide says to you, hey, Josh, war crimes are defined by the winners. I'm a winner.
And I get to make my own definition.
And I get to make my own definition of what that means. Did they win?
They won. I mean, that's what the film's about. And it's, Indonesia could now have a popular movement to unseat these guys, perhaps through mobilizing, organizing in the context of the very corrupt, even criminal electoral democracy that Indonesia has today. Things could change. The balance of power could change. The film has certainly provided ammunition for that fight, but nevertheless, the film is the whole raison d'etre of this film. The reason I made it is because it's an expose of what happens when the killers win. And somehow, I have this feeling that that's not the exception to the rule. Genocide, we think, okay, the Nazis, we think the Khmer Rouge, they were thrown out of power, there have been tribunals, there's been some form of justice, however incomplete and impartial. But I would suppose that's the exception to the rule, that perpetrators of mass political violence normally win and then normally take power. And that's why they perpetrate the violence. If every time it happened or most of the times they have their comeuppance, they wouldn't do it anymore. And then all that's unique in Indonesia, perhaps, is the boasting of the perpetrators. That's an allegory for the rule, a metaphor for the rule. And the reason they boast is simply, it's not just that they won. And this is where it implicates all of us. It's because the rest of the world, at least the Western world, supported them at the time of the killings and have supported them enthusiastically ever since. And they know that. So when they meet a foreigner with a camera, they don't think this is something they should be ashamed of. They boast, and they boast openly.
Joshua Oppenheimer, talking with Charles Monroe Kane about his documentary, The Art of Killing. He's still in touch with Anwar and considers him a friend. The Art of Killing was nominated for a 2014 Academy Award, and it's now available for streaming. I should warn you, it is a very disturbing film. You know, sometimes you have to wonder, is anyone capable of violence? Is brutality bred in our bones? Enter the fierce people. That's what anthropologist Napoleon Chagnon calls the indigenous Yanomamo Indians of the Amazon. His 1968 book about them is one of the best-selling anthropology books of all time. But in the 45 years since he wrote the book, Chagnon has come to a stark conclusion, that the violence and brutality the Yanomamo are famous for is basic human nature. Now, in the anthropology world, that's incredibly controversial, and Chagnon's taken a lot of heat for it. When they talked together, Steve Paulson asked him to take us back to his first contact with the Yanomamo. He was traveling deep in the Amazon with a missionary when they were suddenly surrounded by a group of men with runny noses, all pointing arrows at him. Turned out they were just back from a fight.
The fight didn't happen in the village I was going to, but the people who lived in that village had gone to the club fight and fought with the men in the other village and got the women back. And the villages were about, you know, 4 or 5 hours apart from each other on foot. Anyway, they had this brutal club fight, and the people that they took the woman back from, on their parting enjoinders, said that next time we come to your village, we're going to shoot you and kill you. So when I walked into the village, they thought it was raiders from the other village coming there to get revenge. And that's why they met us with drawn arrows. And, of course, in the jungle, they didn't, well, yeah, we're expecting the anthropologist to get here any day now.
Did they know you were coming?
No.
So this was a total surprise.
Yeah, it was a complete surprise for
them. This white anthropologist would show up in their village.
Yeah. Anyway, after the dogs stopped yapping and were constrained by their owners, they recognized the missionary who was with me. He came in right behind me, and they were real happy to see him. And they chatted for a while, and then presently they went back to snorting their drugs.
Which, so that's what was causing the mucus pouring down their face?
Yeah, the drugs were a ground powder they mixed with ashes from a particular kind of wood, and then they put the substance in the end of a foot-long hollow tube made from a bamboo, and they would blow it up each other's noses with immense power.
Was this some sort of hallucinogen?
Yes, it was a hallucinogenic drug, and they use it almost every day to chant to their spirits and wage war with the spirits against their mortal enemies on the ground. And so they not only fight with bows and arrows, but they have their spirits fighting as well.
So this must have been a total shock to you.
It was. My enthusiasm for interviewing people and taking notes diminished in proportion to the number of times the brush was rattled to the outside and the men ran up with their drawn bows and arrows to see who was trying to get in.
So how did you communicate with them?
With great difficulty. At first they thought there was something defective about me because I didn't understand their language, and they just assumed that I was hard of hearing. So they began saying things louder to me until they were shouting, and finally they realized that this guy's a bobo. He can't understand it. The single thing we're saying, and so they just gave up on me. But before Barker left, I managed to get a list of phrases in the Yanomamo language translated into English that I could then build on, and that's how I learned the language. Little by little, I would substitute new words I learned into the phrases that Barker had given me, and by the end of about 4 or 5 months, I was able to conduct myself in a relatively efficient fashion, as long as there weren't any sophisticated issues involved. Like, you don't start translating myths of Indians in 6 months, despite what Margaret Mead says.
You had been, you still were at that point, a student in anthropology.
Yes, I was a graduate student in anthropology.
What were the biggest surprises to you?
Well, first of all, in all the readings that I had put under my belt in preparation for doing my field research, you'd read ethnographic reports on tribes of Indians that say the Amazon Basin. They have arrows. They have bows. They make pottery. They make their houses out of vines and thatch. They have warfare. They have cross-cousin marriage. Well, I mean, these neutral things like they have warfare. I mean, you would just, reading it in a book, you'd think, well, they have warfare, and we have warfare. Well, I hadn't realized what warfare in the flesh actually meant. I mean, these people, they were the last major multi-village tribe of Indians. There were close to 25,000 of them, but nobody knew that, who were still conducting warfare without being interfered with by either the government of Venezuela or the government of Brazil. Most of these people weren't even aware that they were living in some country that had a name like Venezuela.
Now, when you say they conducted warfare, there would, what, be wars between different villages?
Yeah, they fought mostly over women. If you asked a Yanomama, why did such and such a village split into two parts and one part move away at such and such a place, they'd say, women. We fought over women. That's why we split apart. We couldn't live with each other any longer.
When you say they fought over women, it's like one village would raid another village to abduct women?
No, it wasn't quite that simple. It was easier for them to visit a village, a group of men visit a smaller village coming from a larger village, and then take women with them on the way out when they were going home. And, of course, the men would want to get their women back.
Sure.
And they would henceforth and thereafter sneak up on them and raid them, waiting to get one of the men alone outside and shoot him full of arrows, and then flee and go home.
Was this common, this kind of thing?
Yes. One village that I was studying was raided 25 times in the first 17 months I was living there.
That's, wow.
It had a lot of enemies. It was a big village, but what happens is when you're a big village, you've got a lot of enemies, and if one of them attacks you, that's when all of the other 15 villages who are allied to the first village will jump in because they know that even if it's a large village, they can't possibly retaliate against a group of dedicated men who are trying to get revenge on previous killings. And so their wars would go on and on and on. And
so there was a kind of a cycle of revenge then.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Until one group would eventually move so far away that it would be impractical for raiders to, you know, walk 4 days to raid them because they'd have to travel through territory that wasn't theirs, and that's dangerous.
Now, when I was reading your account of this, I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, it'd be so different from our culture. But there's a piece of me that's thinking, they must see that, I mean, this is counterproductive in some way. I mean, you know, you raid another village, they raid back. And, you know, you kill one of theirs and they kill one of yours. And
well,
I mean, there's a kind of a futility to
this. The history of Europe and the United States in the 20th century, I mean, it was kind of dumb for people to do what they did then. And people are not necessarily rational and logical when it comes to attacking other nations.
Is there sort of a, I don't know, an ethical, are there ethical rules about this kind of thing?
Well, it depends on what your definition of ethics is. There's a sense of fairness and fair play, and it's considered to be poor form to invite somebody to visit your village and then mercilessly fall on them and kill them. But they nevertheless do that. Hmm. It's like talking to an alcoholic who got sick and vomited and really hung over the next day and somebody saying, well, you should learn your lesson. I bet you won't do that again. Well,
yeah. Now, part of the fascination of your story is because it would seem to get to one of the enduring mysteries that we have, which is what were our ancestors like?
Well,
5,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago.
I'm still fighting that battle because anthropology and most of the social sciences are divided on this deep philosophical issue about the nature of man and the state of nature. And because part of the history of anthropology has endorsed the noble savage idea that people in a state of nature are, you know, running through the forest with shining, glistening bodies, perfumed flowers in their hair, altruistically doing whatever they can to help their neighbors. Well, it's not that kind of world out there. And for the longest time, anthropology has denied the importance of biology and the evolution of the human organism because they study culture. And elaborate attempts have been made throughout the history of anthropology to separate human beings from biology because humans have souls and believe in spirits and things of that sort.
Now, I mean, this sounds like a Darwinian story.
It is.
You've been describing. I mean, it's if the wars are basically fought over women, over you know, access to sexual reproduction.
Right. I mean, they fight for reproductively useful or utilitarian goals, not just gold and diamonds, as some of my colleagues would say. They're fighting over women. Gold and diamonds, I can understand, but women, never. The thing that I brought to the attention of my colleagues was there is such a thing as human nature and the evolved organism that we're studying, man, is a product of evolution from higher primates. And the dimensions of that effect on behavior of all primates is a natural history. And one of the most horrible crimes I committed was a publication in the journal Science, one of the most respected journals in the community of academics who are scientists. It includes biology, chemistry, physics, but also anthropology as a science. And one of the articles I published was about Yanomami warfare. And what I found after collecting all of these genealogies and demographic facts and statistics was that men who had killed people, enemies in other villages, had 2.5 times as many wives and 3 times as many children as men their own age who were not killers. And this was offensive to a lot of anthropologists. Mm. And many people have, since that publication in 1988, attempted with ingenious different arguments to undo that argument.
Well, and it's striking that, I mean, you have very vocal admirers, including some of the biggest names in science.
Yeah, that's
Steven
true.
Pinker, E.O. Right. Wilson.
Right.
I mean, it's striking that a lot of them are either evolutionary psychologists or evolutionary biologists.
But they are all evolutionary biologists.
Right. But when you get to cultural anthropology, they tend not to like you.
No, they don't. But that's changing. I was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 2012. A year later, which was just this spring, I was inducted into the National Academy of Sciences. And in a very public, dramatic statement from one of my former professors at the University of Michigan, Marshall Solins, who is now at the University of Chicago, resigned publicly and openly and made a big ceremony out of it because I had been elected to the National Academy of Sciences. He had been elected, you know, 20 years earlier. And the whole point was that he was very much opposed to evolutionary biology or the whole idea of a human nature that was anything other than a cultural nature, and he still is.
Napoleon Chagnon's latest book about the Yanomami Indians of the Amazon is called The Noble Savage. Steve Paulson talked with him. Coming up, don't give up on us yet. There's good news ahead. We humans may be argumentative and warlike by nature, but we're actually becoming more peaceful. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. This hour, we're exploring the heart of darkness, our human propensity for violence. And this has been a pretty depressing hour so far. The underlying message seems to be that The world is a dangerous place, and other people will hurt you. And we're surrounded by those stories, right? They're in the news all the time. But historian Steven Pinker told Steve Paulson that the truth is, no matter what you hear in the news, we humans are actually becoming less violent.
In terms of reducing day-to-day violence, both the insult that escalates into a lethal quarrel or the raiding of a neighboring village to abduct the women and kill the men, that has been driven down by the control of government. When you've got a third party that wants to keep the peace within its kingdom, not for any particularly benevolent reasons, but just because violence among citizens is kind of a nuisance to a king who'd rather keep them alive to supply him with taxes and soldiers, but that pacification of a population will drive violence down. And then as government evolves to a more democratic form, you have the government acting as a third-party dispute resolver through the court system and laws. And instead of having to defend your interests the way the Corleones did by the threat of violence carried out to make it credible, you call the police, you file a lawsuit, and that results in fewer bodies on the floor.
So you're saying it's partly the rise of the nation state. This has contributed to the decline of violence.
Certainly the rise of the state. Yes, states and empires, not necessarily nation states. But the rise of government tends to reduce the rate of lethal quarreling among its citizens. There's also the rise of instruments of commerce, money, contracts, interest, technologies of trade like roads and canals that make it more valuable to buy and sell what you want than to plunder it. And there are a number of reasons to think that the rise of commerce has led to a decline in warfare and violence. Also, I think the rise of education and literacy and cosmopolitanism and knowledge and open free speech have tended to drive down forms of institutionalized violence, partly because people get into the habit of seeing the world from other people's point of view. And the rise of a general intellectual attitude towards social practices. Can we justify what we're doing, or do we have to defend it in argument? And do the people in power have to defend what they do? When you start to have widespread literacy, a free press, people will start to question whether slavery can really be justified or mutilating people as a form of punishment.
Okay, you've mentioned a whole bunch of things here, and I want to sort of pick up a few of them. Coming back to the state, the government, which now often has more power than it used to in previous years, it seems that you could make a different argument, which is that with the rise of the nation state, it is actually much easier to engineer mass killings. Nazi extermination of the Jews or Chairman Mao's eradication of his political enemies during the Cultural Revolution. In other words, maybe there are less frequent violent outbursts, but when they do happen, they're deadlier.
They can be, although it's misleading. If you're talking about the effect of government as a whole over the course of history, and there have been thousands of them, to pick the two or three worst ones gives you a misleading picture of the role of government in general compared to anarchy.
It seems that there is a profound philosophical question at the heart of this, and that is whether we become better human beings, better in terms of being more compassionate, because of our powers of reason, of sort of, you know, coming up with rational underpinnings for moral codes, or whether we act kindly towards other people for more emotional reasons, perhaps because we have been led to think this way through religious upbringing.
You're right that there is an interesting back and forth between the head and the heart, if you will. That is, do we refrain from cruel and destructive practices because we have compassion and empathy for the victims, or because we have a commitment to ideas like universal human rights that don't justify or don't permit the exploitation of other living things. It's very hard to know which came first, but I do think they go back and forth and they can reinforce each other. I don't think it can just be empathy because, quite frankly, I don't think that anyone can literally feel the pain of everyone else on Earth. Maybe I'm a bad person, but I just don't spend that many hours of the day imagining what it's like to be a starving person in South Asia or a victim of war in Africa. On the other hand, I firmly believe that anything that we can do to alleviate hunger and war ought to be implemented. I think that there's no other position can be defended morally, and I'm willing to put it into practice in terms of support for policies, charitable donations. Historically, you see moralistic arguments like how awful it was to be a slave and have a child pulled out of his mother's arms by a cruel slaveholder. But you can also have arguments saying, what right does one person have to own another person? I think they've both been influential. If anything, I would tend to put my bets on the intellectual side, the power of ideas, that one often sees in the history of the abolition of barbaric practices, that it started with briefs from philosophers of the day that then went viral. The pamphlets were distributed, the books sold out, they were translated into every other European language. They were the subject of arguments in the coffee houses and bars and salons and dinner tables, and eventually influenced the decision makers. They probably needed a push of compassion, of sympathetic imagination. What is it like to be an animal who is mistreated? What is it like to be a slave? But the ideas definitely had a huge, powerful influence.
Are you saying humanity is making moral progress? I mean, we're basically becoming better as a species?
Yeah, not that we're, I don't think we've become biologically any better. I don't think that this is a case of Darwinian evolution. But I think our collective global culture has been moving in that direction.
And to speculate into the future then, I mean, if you are right and we are becoming kinder, more compassionate, do you think our moral codes will develop even further?
I suspect they will in many directions. I think that our treatment of farm animals is going to improve. I think that violence against women and children worldwide is going to get better now that it's the target both of shaming campaigns from above and grassroots pressure from below. I think the tolerance of despots and brutal dictators is going to lessen. I think the idea of war between developed countries, which is already pretty much on the way out, is going to become consolidated. That still leaves a number of forms of violence that could still occur. There could still be civil wars. There could still be terrorism. There could still be crime. But to the extent that we can control things by our own decisions, such as the treatment of farm animals, I think that the humanitarian currents will continue.
Steven Pinker. If you want to know more about his argument, we recommend his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. Steve Paulson talked with him. In this hour, we've been talking about the heart of darkness. And before we leave the subject, I've been rereading some of Maya Angelou's poetry. She died last week, and there's one poem in particular that seems to fit what we've been talking about. It's a long poem, but I want to read part of it. We, this people, on this small and drifting planet, whose hands can strike with such abandon that in a twinkling, life is sapped from the living. Yet those same hands can touch with such healing, irresistible tenderness that the haughty neck is happy to bow and the proud back is glad to bend. Out of such chaos, of such contradiction, we learn that we are neither devils nor divines. When we come to it, we, this people, on this wayward floating body created on this earth, of this earth, have the power to fashion for this earth a climate where every man and every woman can live freely without sanctimonious piety, without crippling fear. When we come to it, we must confess that we are the possible. We are the miraculous, the true wonder of this world. That is when, and only when, we come to it. A Brave and Startling Truth by the poet Maya Angelou. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
I'm Laurie Moore, and the book that I would recommend is the book I'm reading right now with my students. It's Carried Away by Alice Munro. This is the Everyman edition of Alice Munro's selected stories. It's a beautiful volume with beautiful creamy paper and a lovely little rust-colored ribbon for a bookmark. And so as an objet, it is just so lovely to hold in one's hands. And to reread Munro's stories is to understand yet again how great she is as an artist, because one encounters new things in these stories that one has forgotten or never even noticed because one was reading along so eagerly the first time. There are stories in Alice Munro where people are decapitated, and there's more than one. She's writing about very exciting, thrilling things, and she's also got her finger on the pulse of human emotions in a very, very lovely, tolerant, you know, a little gimlet-eyed, but she doesn't judge, she presents, and yet her opinions can somehow maybe be discerned, but her opinions aren't really what matter. What matters is the artistry and the architecture of these stories, and the characters, both the main characters and the minor characters, that she draws so vividly. What she's good at is arranging the time of a story so that the most important moment comes last. And so the most important moment may be out of sequence, but she'll tell a story and then she'll end it with something way back in the past of the story that was a moment of purity, a moment of pivot for a character. And at the point that you read it, at the very end, you realize you're reading the very center of the story, and you have more knowledge at that point than you would have had if she had put it chronologically. So you come to it, and it's a fantastically moving thing to do when she does that. She has a very sophisticated sense of architecture when she puts together the sections of time in her stories. It can't be imitated. It's really, really very cool.
Laurie Moore recommends Carried Away by Alice Munro. You can find more bookmarks on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week, one of this summer's most anticipated movies just opened, The Fault in Our Stars. It's a story of two teenagers who fall in love, teenagers who both have cancer.
I believe we have a choice in this world about how to tell sad stories. On the one hand, you can sugarcoat it. And nothing is too messed up that can't be fixed with a Peter Gabriel song. I like that version as much as the next girl does. It's just not the truth.
The Fault in Our Stars is based on a wildly popular young adult novel by John Green. But what you might not know is that it was inspired by a real girl, a friend and fan of John Green's. Her name was Esther Earle. She died of thyroid cancer just a few years ago, at age 16. She inspired the book and the movie and now an international holiday, which is being promoted by a young fan activist network called the Harry Potter Alliance, which was founded by Andrew Slack.
Weeks before Esther's passing, John Green went to Esther and said, "Look, I am making your birthday a holiday. What do you want people to do on Esther Day?" And she simply said the most basic thing that speaks so much, so many volumes to her and to her character, which is, "I want people to tell their friends and family that they love them."
You're not talking about romantic love.
No, we're not talking about. In fact, Valentine's Day is a holiday based on romantic love, and Mother's Day and Father's Day have their own stuff tied into it where people get all angsty about. This is the only baggage-free holiday in our world that is about love. And it is a holiday that was inspired by a young woman who inspired this entire phenomenon of a major blockbuster book and a major blockbuster movie. And when you go see that movie, you're going to walk out and say, geez, you know, I don't have forever on this planet. And I need to tell the people I love them that I love them, because that's really what this comes down to. So on Esther Day, it happens to be the last day of the biggest Harry Potter conference in the world, LeakyCon, which is where Esther met John Green at the first LeakyCon. We're going to all be signing postcards and putting them out to people that we love. We're holding house parties across the world. We want people to sign up and create those, and you can do that at estherday.org. It is a growing network of young people, and as we say in the Harry Potter Alliance, the weapon we have is love.
Well, and there's an even bigger story here, which Esther's story is part of, and you're part of it too. And this is really a story about teenagers, young adult novels, fan groups, and the way all of these are coming together to make real change in the world. And here's one example, for instance, from an organization you founded, the Harry Potter Alliance.
Do you like Harry Potter? And did you ever wish that Harry Potter was real? Well, it kind of is. The Harry Potter Alliance believes that it's time to imagine a better world. Just as Harry and his friends in Dumbledore's army opened the eyes of the wizarding world to Voldemort's return, we are waking up our world to the dark arts present today. The HPA is working to decrease world suck by raising awareness and activism for the issues of our world, like poverty, illiteracy, human rights violations, global warming, and genocide. It's time to become heroes in our own world. It's time to see the parallels from the books that we all love and apply those values in real life. Think about it. Lupin hit
so much for people who say fantasy is escapist.
It's an absurd insinuation that has no grounding in any understanding of history. in terms of how people have organized through story since the beginning of humanity. That's how we organize, that's how we work. Fantasy is not an escape from our world, but an invitation to go deeper into it. And I think those who say it's just escapist should try to read.
What would you say are the biggest achievements the Harry Potter Alliance has done? I mean, what are the real-world impacts it's had?
In terms of service and charity, we've sent 5 cargo planes to Haiti full of life-saving medical supplies. We've funded the protection of thousands of civilians in Darfur and Burma. We've built libraries across the world, and we do a lot on economic equality. And we've done a lot on marriage equality. We've done a lot on immigration reform. What we've seen with the Harry Potter Alliance and other fan activist organizations is that the power here is incredible. This is where social change is happening.
So in the meantime, you've now moved beyond Harry Potter. What other stories does your fan activist base feel strongly about?
Well, there is a kind of migratory pattern that we're witnessing within the Harry Potter fandom of Harry Potter fans going in droves to anything that John Green writes, to anything by Joss Whedon, the creator of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Firefly, to The Hunger Games is a big one.
Well, for example, we should hear some of the work you've done for your Hunger Games campaign.
Enough with the distractions. The Hunger Games are real. Think it's fiction? Think again.
Well, we're looking at The Hunger Games as a story of economic inequality and challenging that. We're doing a campaign called Odds in Our Favor. You can go to oddsinourfavor.org. When so much of the way things are built is for those who have the very few, 1% of the country owns about 40% of the economy. That is crazy.
The fire has started and we will not stop. Not until the odds are in everyone's favor.
We're taking this symbol in the Hunger Games, which is the three-finger salute, the symbol of economic solidarity in the Hunger Games, and we're bringing it into real life so that we can build a low-wage worker movement. And we've been getting these workers across the world to be doing three-finger salutes. And you best believe when November 21st rolls around and we see the first part of the last Hunger Games movie, we're going to be seeing three-finger salutes from the workers themselves.
Andrew, I just want to push back a bit because so far, most of the social justice issues that you've talked about are left-wing or progressive. Don't conservative teens like Harry Potter or The Hunger Games? I mean, doesn't this all feel a bit manipulative?
There's no interest here in manipulating young people. There's interest in honoring the text, the message, and the spirit of the text that we love. And The Hunger Games really does that. And I think that there's also a kind of appreciation and listening to our members about the concerns they have about, you know, going into college and coming out with student debt that past generations didn't have to deal with. And there is not one message to these books. You know, one of my friends actually is one of the co-founders of the Tea Party Patriots, and we talk about this stuff quite a bit. And he has a completely different reading of The Hunger Games, and he's tried to mobilize around that as well. But I would argue that this is not really about the left versus the right. There is a kind of exploitation that's already taken place, where when a movie is put out that has such beautiful messages and such beautiful characters, the way young people are treated is that they are a consumer and not a citizen. And that's only their job, is to buy merchandise that has to do with that. That, I would argue, is manipulative. What I find kind of amazing is that that's viewed as not a problem. That's not just the way the world works. But the minute that a young person becomes somebody who challenges the very exploitative nature of the world that they're living in, then suddenly we're the ones that are manipulative. But there are a lot of people in our world that are silenced every day just for sheer fact that they don't have the microphone. And those young people who do have the microphone, well, with great power comes great responsibility, as one of our heroes, Peter Parker / Spider-Man, would say.
Andrew Slack is the founder of the Harry Potter Alliance. And that's what's on our minds today. But we post new On Our Minds segments on our website every day. You can find them at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show with help from Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Raymond Tungekar. We also had help this week from engineer Brittany True.
Welcome to your life. There's no turning back. Even while we sleep, we will find you acting on your best behavior. Turn your back on Mother Nature. Everybody wants to rule.
Our theme music, not this, the music we use to open the hour, comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strangchamps. Thanks for listening.
The world.
PRI, Public Radio International.